So hey everybody, you can never get too much of Nina Simone. So we're back on Voices from the Frontlines with Ron Collins and Eric Mann. I'm going to start with a book called I've Got the Light of Freedom, the Organizing Tradition, the Mississippi Freedom Struggle. And it's not going to start in 1964. In fact, we're not going to get to 1964 in this book. But we're going to go back to 1962 because I think, you know, one thing about history is 1964 was preceded by 1963, preceded by 62, preceded by 1955, which is the Montgomery bus boycott and the Bandung Conference, preceded by the March on Washington that A. Philip Randolph tried to have in the middle of the war, which forced President Roosevelt to integrate the armed forces, was preceded by the work of W.E.B. Du Bois during the 30s and the anti-lynching movements, etc., preceded by Marcus Garvey during the 1920s, and we just can go backwards and backwards, but the point is that all that work actually does build on itself, and now we're in a terrible historical period because all that work has pretty much been destroyed in terms of the popular historical memory, and a whole new generation, in particular of black youth, but of all youth, have been pretty much denied that entire history. So for some of us who go into 16 books we've read about this, a lot of people have not read any books about it, or if they read it, they have no ability to contextualize it. So I'm going to start by reading you, as I said, the section from an amazing book called I've Got the Light of Freedom by Charles M. Payne. That's got tremendous reviews. It's been around for about 20 years, I think, now. But one thing about it, as I preface it, is people try to make the case that what either the story of called local people, ordinary people. There's a basic rap that says that during the 1960s, the history was always about Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, but you didn't realize that there were ordinary people out there on the grassroots doing the work. So this is going to get to the story of the real grassroots. And by doing that, they try to create like a false counterposition between the grassroots and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, as if there was no relationship, or as if in some ways Malcolm X and Martin Luther King were not grassroots. It's meaningless. People all come out of some roots, and if they're college educated or they came out of prison, if you become elevated to become a leader, that doesn't make you less grassroots. It just means, as Chris Mathis once said, a black auto worker, it seems like for every additional book I read, some people think I'm less black. So it's sort of like, the smarter I get, you're less grassroots. No, the whole point of this book was not to glorify the grassroots. The point of this book was trying to show there's a dialectical relationship between the people that had been in the South, organizing for years and years, not recognized, and the students who came down to the South. And that was an explosive combination, as it always have. And then also, as you're going to read about this Sam Block, some of the students who went back to the South were from the South. So it's much more complicated, and with all those prefaces, let me start reading, which is called Wyatt Earp in the summer of 1962. Wyatt Earp being a famous white sheriff who was a bad guy, and they had a TV show about him. So with the Kennedy administration blessing, the voter education project had been established. In June 1962, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee received $500,000 of voter education project funds. And with that, they went ahead with their plans for an enlarged voter registration drive in six counties, Washington, Coahoma, Sunflower, Bolivar, Marshall, and LaFleur. Bob Moses was the statewide director of the project. They sent one young man to Greenwood, Sam Block, 23 years old at the time. Now let's just take this one paragraph and what my mind understands. First, we understand that Kennedy is trying by 1962 to do something about getting black people to vote in the South. Why? He's under tremendous pressure. And two, he feels like if he's going to ever defeat the white Southerners who dominate the Democratic Party, he's got to get some black voters in the South to support civil rights. Second thing interesting is in June of 1962, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee accepted $5,000 of this VEP funds, which meant that there's some relationship between the administration and foundations. Not inherently wrong, but just to know that that was going on and that SNCC at the time was aware of that. Then Bob Moses was the statewide director of the project, Bob Moses being a very important historical figure that many of you know about and many of you don't, and I won't go into that now, except he was a college-educated, brilliant organizer that came into Mississippi, played a role only for about 2 or 3 years and left because he didn't want to be essentially the cult of the personality and was afraid people were considering him the Black Moses. But the whole story of Bob Moses could be 10 books. But they send one young man to Greenwood, Sam Block, 23 years old at the time. And a lot, this is going to be about Sam Block and the example of one person in the civil rights movement that explains a lot about how Mississippi Summer developed 2 years later. Block, from nearby Cleveland, had been identified by Amzie Moore as a likely recruit for the movement. Sorry, I got to stop again. Amzie Moore is one of the Black leaders who's been in Mississippi for his whole life, is one of the leaders who Bob Moses is looking for when he goes down to Mississippi and brings Bob Moses in and sort of says, I've been here forever. I've been fighting the Klan forever. But we want some of your students here. And the relationship between Amzie Moore and Robert Moses is one of the explosive dynamics that when you take a young man like Ron Collins, who's going to be going out organizing, he's going to be looking for an Amzie Moore, who could be Barbara Lott Holland, who could be Della Bonner. And again, it's that relationship between folks that came directly out of the oppressed and people who were partly out of the oppressed, of course, and still were able to go to college. That dynamic is very interesting. All right, now I'm going to read for a while. Block's mother cooked, kept house, and cared for the children of a local judge. His father did construction work and worked at a local cotton compress until an accident at work rendered him unemployable. After graduating from high school, he attended a teacher's college in St. Louis prior to a stint in the Air Force that was cut short by his asthma. By this time, the Freedom Riots had started, which is about 1960-61, parenthesis, and he wanted to be back in the South anyway. When he did get back to Cleveland around October 1961, the Freedom Riders had passed on to other things, jail mostly. He took a job at his uncle's gas station and started taking classes at Mississippi Vocational College in Itabena, 7 miles from Greenwood, which meant that he started meeting young people from Greenwood. Amzie Moore, who owned the other Black service station in Cleveland, was an old friend of the Blocks and lived down the street from them. Sam talked with Moore frequently. Block, a teenager at the time of Emmett Till's murder in 1955, was very much affected by it and the way Amzie Moore spoke up about the killing. When Block lost his service station job for arguing with a white customer, he told Amzie Moore that he, quote, wanted to do something. Moore, the Reverend James Bevo of SCLC and Bob Moses, invited him to work with SCLC setting up citizenship classes. In 1961, Septima Clark's citizenship program had been transferred from Highlander to SCLC, and they entered Mississippi the same year, started in Clarksdale, where Aaron Henry, a member of the SCLC board, was a natural link. SCLC's James Bevel, a native of Itabena just outside of Greenwood, lived with Amzie Moore starting citizenship classes in several small Delta towns. Block spent much of 1962 doing the same work. As part of their preparation for expanded voter registration efforts, SNCC held a workshop on registration at the Highlander Center, then in Knoxville, in June 62. Block attended, as did Curtis Hayes and Hollis Watkins. Parenthesis, Hollis Watkins is going to be chairing the 50th anniversary of the Mississippi Freedom Summer. The workshop, following a format frequently used at Highlander, brought experienced activists from across the South to talk with the young people who had been recruited by SNCC. Together, they studied state registration laws, discussed strategies of persuasion to be used in canvassing, and strategies for penetrating a community. They engaged in role-playing exercises modeled around the kinds of dilemmas the new recruits could expect to encounter in the field. They got plenty of advice. S.R. Jenkins, whose problems had simulated the development of the citizenship schools, was there from South Carolina to testify to the importance of the vote. Since his group has gotten started, 4,000 Black people had been added to the rolls. The kids on the islands now at a high school for the first time. They had bus transportation. Police were learning to keep the night's gift to themselves. If you were taken before a magistrate, you had a chance of fair treatment. One man advised them to sell voting as a Christian thing to do. Another, almost describing what would become SNCC's style of organizing, advised organizers to, quote, go to their homes, eat with them, talk the language that they talk, associate with them on a personal level, then go into your talk about the vote. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices. I'm reading from I've Got the Light of Freedom by Charles M. Payne. Bernice Robinson from Johns Island, who a few years earlier had not thought of herself competent to run a single citizenship class, was also prophetic, noting that around Knoxville, people acted like women couldn't do anything. She was there to testify to the contrary. People, she said, ignore the fact that women do the hardest work. She illustrated with the story of a male minister who agreed to head up a registration campaign and failed to follow through. She had to finish the work for him, but of course he got all the credit. Another woman warned against adopting the local class snobberies. Don't ignore the bootlegger. He talks to a lot of people. Put him on your committee. A man from a rural area questioned the need for developing a personal relationship with the people you are trying to reach. Rural people get very few letters, so they take those they get very seriously. He had always gotten a good response by organizing his campaigns around written appeals. The young people were admonished against bickering with each other organizations. Push your program, not your organization. And one way to do that is give as much responsibility as possible to local people. They were warned that preachers could be a problem, but that alienating them wasn't going to help anything. They were warned against assuming that they knew what the local problems were. They would have to learn to listen to the people who live with the problems. They were reminded that everything they did reflected on their movement. If they got caught drunk, that reflected in the movement. If they failed to go to church, that reflected in the movement. Miles Horton ended one session by pointing out that a Delta farmer who had lived through things the young people had only read about had very real reasons for his fear. But that didn't mean that a person, no matter how old, could not be challenged so long as you respected the basis for those fears. Wow, we're going to keep going. The advice the young people received from the older organizers was often divergent, even contradictory. From Highlander's point of view, that was not a problem. The intent was to expose the kids to as rich a body of concrete experience, to as wide variety of perspectives as possible. In the field, the recruits would have to cut and tailor what they'd learned to fit their particular situations and their particular talents. It was tradition at Highlander to end workshops by asking, "And what are you going to do when you get back home?" Near the end of the week, the recruits were asked to draft a written plan of attack for whatever community we're going into. Thus, the young recruits went into the field armed with as much vicarious experience as the older activists in Highlander could make available to them. Block returned from the workshop with Moses, Hollis Watkins, and Curtis Hayes in Amsie Moore's 1949 Packard, singing freedom songs as they made their way back to Mississippi. Watkins and Hayes went back to Hattiesburg, and Bob Moses took Sam Block to Greenwood. Block had asked to be assigned to Greenwood in part because it had been part of the Till killings. Moses warned him about the possibility of being killed there himself. SNCC's initial entry into many towns is reminiscent of the Old West, with one or two marshals coming up to clean up Dodge City. Arriving just after mid-June, Block was to be a one-man movement for much of the summer. Left on his own resources, he was able to contact some of the students he had met at Mississippi Vocational. They put him in touch with Mrs. McNeese, principal of the elementary school. Innocent of Black's intentions, she rented him a room. As she would go to school in the morning, this is Sam Block talking, I would go canvassing, just talking to people in the community about voter education and registration, sort of testing the pulse of the people, hanging around the pool halls, wherever people were, the laundromat, running around the grocery stores, meeting people. I was also introduced as a student at Mississippi Vocational College. I found that there were a lot of angry people in Greenwood. I found that the people who were most receptive to me were the older people. Mr. Cleveland Jordan sat me down and gave me a whole history of what had been going on in LaFleur County. He told me about how he decided to start a voter education movement in the early 50s. He gave me the names of those persons who were involved in that and the names of those who felt and also were still interested in getting a voter education movement started. Finally, we were to get our first meeting of about 15 or 20 people together, and we met at the Elks Hall. Mr. Jordan was an Elk, and we began to set up some sort of an organizational structure, gave people responsibilities, let them know what I would be doing to sort of watch out for me. They knew the history of Greenwood. And I asked them for suggestions of things they felt I should do, places they thought I should go, and people with whom they thought I should talk. Mr. Jordan had been a member of the Citizens League in the 1950s and had worked with the NAACP, although he had not been a member himself. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. I'm reading from the book I've Got the Light of Freedom by Charles M. Payne. In about 5 minutes, Ron and I are going to talk a little bit about this book. Block began teaching the Freedom songs, after which Elks asked him to leave, claiming they didn't like all that singing. In fact, they had been pressured by the mayor. Having lost his meeting place, he then lost his living quarters. Mrs. McNeese, his landlady, began receiving threatening calls and he had to move. Block slept in an abandoned car for a week before Robert Burns, a friend of Mrs. McNeese, took Block in and was very supportive of the work Block was doing. But the police arrested Burns on dubious charges, and Block had to move again. For a while, he and the other SNCC workers, who were in and out of town, had to stay in Cleveland and commute to Greenwood. Because the Freedom Rides had generated so much excitement in Mississippi the year before, people associated Block with that. People would just get afraid of me. They say, he's a Freedom Rider. I was just up there to stir up trouble. Even young people crossed the street when they saw him coming. The idea that they were just going to start trouble and then move on, leaving the people to suffer the consequences, was something that SNCC and COFO workers heard all the time, and with some justification. It looked to many as if that had happened in Macomb. Nevertheless, Block was able to find some people right away who were receptive to his message, at least in part because he had people like Mr. Jordan steering him. VEP Records, Voter Education Project Records, for July and August, so he was taking people down to the registrar's office at least a couple of times a week, usually just four or five people a day, but sometimes twice that. They weren't just getting registered, but they were going down. By the end of July, he was able to get two of the churches in town to let him use their building sporadically. One of those churches was Wesley Methodist Chapel, which had a history of political activity. Indeed, in April, just before Block came, the Regional Council on Negro Leadership had met there. Before taking his first group down to register, Block told Bob Moses that he didn't know what might happen and needed reinforcements. Moses promised to send LeVon Braun and Lawrence Guillot soon. Before they got there, Greenwood had his first mass meeting, publicized by word of mouth only, and held at the Reverend Aaron Johnson's First Christian Church. Sam taught the Freedom songs, and Mr. Jordan endorsed him, saying, as Block recollects it, something like, "Well, we got somebody now that's going to help us do something. We've been waiting for somebody. Now here he is. I want you all to give him all the support that you can. Don't be scared of him. Treat him like he's one of us, because he is." The next day on the street, he got a different kind of reception. People were asking him when they were going to have another meeting and when they were going to learn some more of those songs. And I began to see the music itself as an important organizing tool to really bring people together. Not only to bring them together, but also as the organizational glue to hold them together. I started to give people the responsibility of thinking about a song that they would want to sing that night and of changing that song, you know, from a gospel song. So, Ron Collins, you're a young organizer with the Labor Community Strategy Center. You go on the buses, you go to LACC, you're out trying to in some way replicate this experience. What's your reaction to this reading so far?
Really just a level of reverence for how much work young people did. And really, one, being able to go into a place like Mississippi, for instance. I organize here in LA, right, which is a different experience. This is where I'm from. But really just thinking through how much young people did and going to outside of their comfort zones and really fighting the good fight, as it were, really thinking through not just one, organizing around their politics, but really getting to learn and build community, right? That was one of the big things, was like, they didn't just, and that was, you know, really part of SNCC's model. It wasn't just going in and, oh, okay, here's what I'm about, here's how we're going to get the vote, but it was really beginning to learn and understand those human experiences that make up people's everyday lives. And so for me, it's a huge learning experience to see how folks did that, and understanding that that's part of why they were so successful was because they made those human connections with folks.
Was there anything in listening to this that made you think there's something you'd like to do better? Was there any sense of a self-critical observation? Was there any sense of something that triggered, hey, I do that, and that's something I figured out? Tell me some of those multiple conflicting responses.
Yeah, so I think the first thing that I want to definitely do better is talk to more older organizers, definitely, and learn more about their experiences. I think there was one line talking about how they had just as much vicarious experience as the older organizers had actual experiences, and definitely wanting to build my own level of vicarious experiences. There's, you know, a wealth of knowledge here in Los Angeles and the movement of folks who have done so much work in the movement. And then, so for me, I think that just wanting to learn more of that history and what older folks have done. And then one thing that I think that I try to embody in my own work is just that level of tenacity, the level of constantly going out and, all right, so, you know, I lost one house, gotta go find another, you know, it's like you get off of one bus organizing folks and maybe it doesn't go so well, but rather than sit and fall down, what do? You go get on the next bus and you have another conversation and you try and figure those things out. So really, I think for me, it's wanting to embody the level of tenacity that these folks have, and also the level of courage. It's something I constantly ask myself is, could I really hack it as an organizer back then, right? You know, organizing now looks very different. I don't know if I could sleep in a car for a weeks at a time, you know, and I don't know if I have that ability, you know, and the, you know, it's a real dedication and commitment, not just to the movement, but to building a better society and improving human conditions for folks, that I think is really amazing.
This is Eric Mann. That was the voice of Ron Collins, and this is an amazing book called I've Got the Light of Freedom. In just 4 or 5 pages, I'm going to read some more. I just would like to read for a couple of hours. To a lot of you, by the way, our listeners, have said that you like that I read. You know, that we have a lot of people who talk here, but why can't books be on radio? You know, here's beautifully constructed prose where the concepts are so carefully constructed. And I'm glad that a lot of you like that I read on the show, because I read like a fiend, and I'd like to share this with you. So my thoughts were a couple of things. I think you know that in about 2 weeks, Julie and I are going to go down to Mississippi and try to interview a lot of veterans of Mississippi Freedom Summer. When all this happened, I was in the North, and I was working in a settlement house in the South Bronx as a social worker. And when I heard about what happened down South, I joined the Congress of Racial Equality in the North. And one of the things, the reason I want to go down South, besides everything else, is my reverence for the work that the people did, and my belief that I'm not sure I had the courage to do it, that I had, there was a period of tremendous courage. Everybody was asked to be courageous, but some people were more courageous than others. Everybody was asked to take a risk and go to the level of their, outside their comfort zone, but these were still people that lived in another planet in some way. The South was a racist police state in a way that's almost incomprehensible. Their level of courage, to me, is always the cutting edge of every other question, which is, are you willing to put your body on the line, you know? And I don't know. I went to prison for 18 months. I was in solitary confinement. Obviously, I've learned how to pay dues. But still, I look to them with a tremendous reverence, as you said. The second thing that I thought was really interesting, building on your point again, is that if you listen to all the advice, it was conflicting advice or contradictory advice. Listen to people. Well, don't completely listen to people, because you have to have your own politics. You got to, you know, know people would actually respond better to letters. No, be with the preacher, but don't be too much with the preacher. But you can't antagonize the preacher. And so after you get this all this vicarious information and advice, you realize, oh, my God, I'm just sort of grabbing this set of interconnected ideas, and then I have to translate it. I have to figure out what does that mean in practice. But I think we know a couple of things. One, you can't not organize people you don't love. You can't organize people you don't respect. If you don't believe that the people you're talking to have already had just great courage in living their life, regardless of their consciousness, then you'll not connect with them. But secondly, you may have something to teach, as well as a lot to learn. So the great ability to listen and to talk and then to listen is a lot in the fabric of all this. So everybody, you're on Voices from the Front Lines. It's 4:30 KPFK, 90.7 FM, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, streaming live on the web at kpfk.org. This is Eric Mann. I'm the host of Voices from the Front Lines. And this is Ron Collins, an organizer with the Strategy Center. And Julian Lamb was also in studio, recording and videoing this. You know, I'm really privileged to have this show and to be able to be the host of this amazing show. And the reason I say it's an amazing show is because it's all about people I care about and respect and giving their voice to you, and we're going to keep going. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. So now we're back to reading, because let me explain what's going on. We're trying to build the structure of Mississippi Freedom Summer 1964. But the concept of organizing, which is what I've done my whole life, is the basis of any social change. The story of what you're hearing here is what, unsadly, most of you don't comprehend or do. And yet, history has been made when you say the labor movement, the anti-war movement, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the gay movement. Somebody woke up in the morning with a theory and a practice and went out and talked to other people through a radio show, through a leaflet, through a sit-in. They debated what was the right thing and the wrong thing to do. But this shows the planned and conscious character, which is what Lenin talked about, that organizing is not spontaneous, that struggle is often spontaneous and great, and you need spontaneity, but you also need consciousness and leadership and organization. So this is all about black folks sitting down and trying to figure out how to overthrow Jim Crow. After a second mass meeting, Block decided to take the first group, a group of about 21 people, down to the courthouse. They were older people, anywhere from 40 years of age to 70 or 80. At the courthouse, the group was first stonewalled by Martha Lamb, the registrar, and then confronted by the sheriff, who wanted to know where Block was from, since he, the sheriff, quote, knew every nigger and his mammy around Greenwood. According to a much-told story in the movement, Block asked him if he knew any colored people, at which point the sheriff spat in his face and told him to get out of town. Block's reply was, "If you don't want to see me here, I think the best thing for you to do is pack up your clothes and leave. Get out of town, because I'm here to stay." Public defiance of, quote, the laws was an important element in the style of many of the workers in the Delta, and it was certainly part of Block's style. It's a question of defiance. As Block took his people home, the law enforcement officers followed, taking down names and addresses, but some people refused to act intimidated, shouting back, "You don't scare me no more. You don't scare me no more." Block endeared himself to the authorities by bringing a police brutality charge against them. On the 28th of July, 14-year-old Welton McSween was arrested and charged with having peeped into a white woman's window. Even though he claimed to have been at work at the time of the incident, McSwain was kicked and beaten with nightsticks, a blackjack, and a bullwhip until his father came for him. His father's boss had to call and ask him that the boy be released. Block took affidavits on the case, and he had Robert Burns, who was a photographer on the side, photograph the welts on the boy's body. The material was sent to what Howard Zinn called the bottomless, bucketless well of the Justice Department. Police took the following Block home from the registrar, or having the police cruiser stay with him all day when he was canvassing door to door. Through all of this, he continued to make slow progress, as suggested by some of the reports he filed in that summer. On July 26th, he wrote, "Sorry I'm late with my report, but I'm making an excuse that only satisfies the person that makes it, so I'll try to do better next time. Okay. Gee, may I say I'm glad that things have begun to come my way at last. Wait. I am not excited, just glad now. Today, Mr. Jerry T. Chestnut, a leading citizen of Greenwood, was in the office. He made himself known. He is a leading salesman for some big insurance company, a registered voter, a member of the Flora County Voters League, a well-known person. He wants to offer his support financially and bodily. In addition to that, he's going to be responsible for contacting some of the big men and women that he knows will give their support in both ways. I'm waiting on one of my fellows to come back from Mr. Bueller's workshop. His name is Dewey Green, a student at Mississippi Vocational College, an ex-Navyman. He's pretty well ready to work, but plans some direct action here Monday morning at 9. The people going to participate have been pretty well disposed to what's happening. By the way, I cannot send a budget for this week because I did not have any money to spend anyway. My fundraising campaign has been rather slow. For this 2 weeks, I was donated $10 by one of the young fellows that runs a pool hall on Broad Street. He said that he's going to support us from now on, regardless of what happens. I've been speaking so enthusiastic to the people around here until they would be less than human if they didn't do something to help. Now, folks, I want you to start calling in to 818-985-5735 if you'd like to talk about the black struggle in the South and particularly respond to the readings that we're doing here. In terms of building our listenership, there's something I want to say to our listeners. 818-985-5735. You have to understand a listener-sponsored radio show means that when you call up, you're part of this show. So if you say something in the interest of the show. Say something in the interest of the conversation. Think that all the other people listening are listening to this as part of the conversation, not as a separate thing that you just happen to want to say. So respond to what Ron Collins is saying, respond to what I'm saying, respond to mainly Charles M. Payne, I've Got the Light of Freedom, and sure, respond to the life of Sam Block that gives you a sense of what it's going to take to build a movement today. 818-985-5735. You have about 2 minutes if you stay on subject, and we'd love to hear from you. If you'd like to call, we'd like to talk to you. If we don't call, we'll just have plenty to read and plenty to talk about. Okay, so I'm going to keep going. There's plenty going on here right now. I'm busy trying to keep up with the people. For the people I have working, it's taken a long time to get them to do anything at all, so I can't afford to lose them now. Mrs. Corrine Gay was told that if she knew the Constitution, she had to write a poem about it. She couldn't write the poem, so she couldn't take the test. The FBI is here. They seem to have every white person in Greenwood upset. They're wondering how the FBI got all the information they have about Greenwood. I don't have anything to say about money because there is none here. As a matter of fact, there hasn't been any for a month now, so why worry? I mean here. Ron Collins, what are you thinking?
Yeah, I think he's speaking to a lot of the struggles that organizers are still having. One, new funding, right? You know, that's always a huge thing in the movement, is one trying to get funds. But also, I think the thing that strikes me the most is his level of positivity, right? In thinking through how important that is for an organizer when particularly looking in the face of a lot of adversity, and you go and you run up against folks who are like, I'm not with this, or, you know, you're crazy, I want to join this other group, whatever. But really thinking through how he actually used positivity as a tool, literally saying, you know, you'd have to be heartless not to, you know, not to engage with somebody who had that much positivity and that much life around them. That actually reminds me a lot of organizers that I've met, some of the best organizers. The first thing that comes to mind is Sun Young Yang. There's so much energy and so much vibrance that she brings to organizing. It's very much the same. It's like you'd have to be heartless not to want to do whatever it is that they're asking of you. And just really, again, I think it goes back to that determination, you know, just continuing to fight the fight, understanding that, you know, funds are getting low. I'm not necessarily, you know, in the best place personally, but still wanting to understand that the work that you're doing is so much bigger than what you personally are going through. And I think that that's one of the pivotal things for us as young people to really begin to think about, is that how much bigger the movement is than us, right? It's definitely a very long and storied history for Black folks in this country of fighting this fight, and wanting to really think through what it means for us to continue that fight in a way that is incredibly selfless, right? Because that is, to me, what the roots of the movement were, is to, yes, you know, fight for your own individual rights, but really you're fighting for the rights and the ability of the entire community to be able to live in a healthy and sustainable way.
This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines, 818-985-5735. If you'd like to respond, we're talking about Mississippi Freedom Summer. In this case, we're talking about 2 years before Mississippi Freedom Summer in Mississippi, to give you the sense that movements are built step by step, year by year, and there wouldn't have been Mississippi Freedom Summer 64 without the work of Sam Block. 818-985-5735. I'll just have one more observation, and we will go to the phones. I think another thing that's very interesting to me is someone once observed, it was Mark Anthony Johnson when he first got onto the Planning Committee. He says, oh, I'm starting to get this. This is like a chess game. I get it. It's not just we're angry. It's not just we're righteous. Move after move, move after move. They make a move. We counter move. They beat us back. We try to surround them. It's an endless chess game. And I think what you see here is not just his level of courage, but how brilliant the man is and how unpretentious he is as an intellectual. He makes a relationship with this person, then he makes a relationship with the insurance guy, then that guy opens up the door, then he goes to the church and he makes finally an ally. The ally says, hey, don't be afraid of this guy. So you need somebody in the community to vouch for you. And there are other people who are what we call gatekeepers in the Black community, gatekeepers in the Latino community, gatekeepers in the white liberal community for sure. And you have to get around them and see if there's any gate openers. And the gate openers right now are very courageous people that would say, hey, Ron, let me introduce you to my congregation, or let me introduce you to the people in my neighborhood, or let me introduce you to my neighbor, that opens up those doors. So I'm really struck by, and also his sense of humor in the middle of God knows what. I mean, all his jokes about money, you know, mm-hmm. And I have to say, Black folks' use of humor to deal with some of the most unbearable things is another source of positivity, as he was saying, which is absolutely right. I think an organizer at his or her core must be optimistic and must believe this thing can win. if you convey appropriate doubt, you don't have to be totally positive. You don't have to be, you're not selling something. But if it's a fundamental belief that you don't want to go to war and you don't believe we have a chance to win, that will be picked up by other people. And if you believe that you want to go to war, as Sam does, and that he thinks we can win, he finds other people to join. Let's take the first call. Is it Rudy? Roy from Los Angeles.
Yes. Eric, good afternoon to you. And to your guest, Ron. Ron, I give you a lot of credit for being an organizer. And if a person has never been in the walk that you're walking and in the walk that you have walked through, they'd never know what it means to have true dedication and heart to do the kind of things you do. And, you know, I'm not going to make a long story. I appreciate people like you, because I went back home to my home in Charleston, South Carolina, and I changed the International Longshoremen Association when everybody had doubted. I helped. I nominated a new president, nominated a delegate, got my president into the nominated, and after his term, the delegate that I nominated, he is now running the International Longshoremen Association, which is Kenneth Riley, and he's been in that for over 25 years. And nobody didn't like the idea of me upsetting the card that I would actually take out their man who they had control of and put people in who was going to help the organization. Now there's three International Longshoremen Association in Charleston, South Carolina. I applaud you, Ron. Thank you.
And brother, stay on the line for a minute because I want to tell you a very interesting story. This isn't a perfect example of someone who calls in, and some people, I have to say, have more opinions than actions. Well, in my book, Playbook for Progressives, 16 Qualities of a Successful Organizer, there's a story about both Bill Fletcher and Ken Riley. And Ken Riley was, as this brother just said, a black president of the International Longshoremen Workers Union, and they were involved in a struggle in which, I think it was called, I'm sorry, it's my own book, the Charleston Six, I believe, that what they were charged with rioting because when the police attacked them, of course, they defended themselves. So just let me take a couple of minutes with what this brother just said because it's so rich. First of all, he just calls up and says, oh, by the way, I don't want to take up your time. But he just did something historically more important than, I mean, we got to find him because he tells the story as an organizer of how he worked inside the unions, in this case, the International Longshoremen Workers Union. He helped elect Ken Riley. Ken Riley led the struggle. Bill Fletcher helped Ken Riley. And they're both in my book, Playbook for Progressive, 16 Qualities of the Successful Organizer. So it's almost like somebody just jumped out of the pages of another book. And I can't thank the brother who just called enough. Ron, any thoughts on it?
Yeah, first I want to say thank you so much, Roy. I think a lot of folks, you say you're an organizer. One, a lot of folks don't really know what that even means. And then two, don't really know the level of dedication that it does take. So I appreciate, you know, somebody even recognizing that. And then I appreciate the work that you've done. Young organizers like myself really stand on the work that organizers have done before us. And if it wasn't for the skill sets that have been passed on to us by other organizers, we couldn't do what we do. So we definitely want to appreciate those who have done this work for years and years before us to be able to get us to a point where we can do this work.
Well, so we're still in the book. Charles M. Payne, I've Got the Light of Freedom, The Organizing Tradition, The Mississippi Freedom Struggle. Of course, we're now going to get to another amazing historical figure, which is Fannie Lou Hamer. Another important target for COPFO in the Delta was Sunflower County, immediately west of LaFour County, where, according to Fannie Lou Hamer, every white man who could afford a gun and a dog was a police officer. Things haven't changed. Sunflower was an inviting target, partly because it was there that Senator James Eastland, then the ranking Democrat in the Senate, owned a 5,400-acre plantation. He was, at the time, getting about $100,000 a year in federal agricultural subsidies, which didn't stop him from railing against government handouts to the so-called shiftless poor. One focus of activity in the county was Rulesville, a town of about 1,100. Around 1960, Amzie Moore, back to him, accompanied a local group to the courthouse to register, but they were turned away by the highway patrol. Sometime in early 1962, a local resident, Mrs. Celeste Davis, has started citizenship classes under the auspices of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Moore and Bob Moses started visiting her in August. On the 14th, five went down to register. On the 16th, four more. The mayor of Ruleville was a Mr. Charles Durrow. He was a mayor of Justice of the Peace. He owned the largest store in town and was a newscaster for the local radio station. On the 17th, he paid a visit to Mrs. Davis's father-in-law, a worker in the city sanitation department, to tell him that anybody attending those classes was going to get a one-way ticket out of town. He also suggested that Mr. Davis's city job was in jeopardy. On the 19th, three student workers arrived. Charles McLaurin and Landy McNair were both Mississippians. Charlie Cobb was a Howard University student who had been in Mississippi all 3 days. 2 days after they arrived, McLaurin and McNair were arrested and then released without being charged. In Sunflower County, one of the most noticeable of these was Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer. For the previous 18 years, Mrs. Hamer had worked and lived on the Marlow Plantation outside of Ruleville. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. I'm reading from I've Got the Light of Freedom by Charles M. Payne. She had been a fair sharecropper for most of that time, and in 1962 she was the plantation timekeeper. She had, as she phrased it, something of a reputation for not having good sense, which meant that she complained about conditions more than was thought advisable. On a Sunday in late August, her pastor announced a mass meeting to discuss registration. She had never heard of voter registration, had no idea what a mass meeting might be, but she went, partly out of curiosity and partly because a friend asked her to go. SCLC's eloquent and fiery James Bevel was the main speaker. As soon as she heard people explaining what voting meant, quote, "I could just see myself voting people out of office that I know was wrong." Although she frequently cited that mass meeting as a turning point, she was politically active before that. In one interview, she mentioned selling NAACP memberships, and while she's vague about the time, she appears to me in the 1950s. In the 50s, she did regularly attend the annual Mount Bio Days, organized by T.M.L. Howard, which would have brought her in contact with the NAACP and RCNL networks. Hollis Watkins remembers that when Amzie Moore took him on a tour of the Delta in 1962, several months before the Bevel meeting, one of the people he met was Mrs. Hamer, implying that she was already on Moore's key contact list. Like so many of the others, it wasn't so much that she was found by the movement as that she'd been searching for it. Wow, we got to take a minute on that. Oh boy, I'm just reading another paragraph. It's more important. She first attempted to register on the 31st of August. As soon as she got back to the plantation, she was informed that her boss was looking for her. She was frightened, but when her boss came down and told her to either go withdraw her application or get off the plantation, she wouldn't back down. "Mr. D, I didn't go down there to register for you. I went down to register for myself." She left the plantation that night, moving in with Mrs. Tucker, a friend of hers in Ruleville. In early September, her husband Pap went into the maintenance shop on the plantation and saw buckshot shells lying out, which was puzzling. There was no form of hunting that requires buckshot in September. On the 10th of September, night riders fired into Mrs. Tucker's home and also into the home of the McDonald family, who had taken in some of the SNCC workers. Two young women were injured. Charlie Cobb of SNCC was arrested and charged with the shooting. He was released the next day, but the shooting and his arrest terrorized the town. Okay, Ron, you get some of the last words. This is KPFK 98.7 FM. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. Ron, you're going to get most of the last thoughts about Fannie Lou Hamer and anything you learned from that last version of the reading.
I, one, love reading about Fannie Lou Hamer. She's one of the everyday sheroes of the civil rights movement that I just feel like people don't know enough about. And particularly thinking through, I mean, someone who was a sharecropper, right, and what courage it took for them to speak out in the rural South, right, and then to not just speak out, but then to get other people to speak out. I mean, I think the reading, if anything, just showed you how extreme the reactions were, right? She just went to hand in some paperwork. And from that, she lost her job and somebody attempted to kill her. And so that just goes to show the incredible level of violence, one, that they were facing. But then, two, particularly for a woman to stand up with that kind of courage, I think it's just amazing. And Fannie Lou Hamer is just one of those folks, like I said, that I feel like we should read constantly. And for folks who are everyday working class people who feel like they can't do anything, I definitely think she's one of those sheroes that people should look to and read more about, because she was just an everyday person who really made a huge impact in Mississippi.
And I'd add, by ending with saying that, if you work with the Labor Community Strategy Center and the Bus Riders Union, you also see Beverly Taylor, you see Barbara Lott Hollins, you see Della Bonner. You see everyday people in the leadership of a real movement today coming out of the class. This is why we focus on the black working class. We focus on black disabled people, black unemployed people, black skilled people, black professors, black ice skaters, all united fronts. But still, it's the sharecroppers, it's the domestic workers, it's the Rosa Mirandas, it's the others who are going to make history. And that's why I read history, because I want us to make history. So you've been listening to Voices from the Frontlines. This is your host, Eric Mann. You've been listening also to Ron Collins, who's really happy that you came in studio, Ron, and spent time with me. Also Julian Lamb, who's a really critical part of the Voices from the Frontlines team. Check out our website at www.voicesfromfrontlines.com. I want to thank our producer, Crystal McMillan, our web organizer, Tanya Bernard, all the people at the Labor Community Strategy Center. I want to thank Charles Payne. I want to thank John Dittmer. And next week, we're going to be on, we think, with Barbara Ransby, a historian. We may be on with Charles M. Payne, which is very exciting. We may be on with Robin Kelly, but we'll be on with some great people. So come on back next Tuesday at 4. You're on Voices from the Frontline. Take good care of yourself, and yes, all power to the people.